Hello and welcome to another episode of Let Me Finish with myself, Thomas Zacchio, where each time I'm joined by a very special guest to chat about a topic that we get so passionate about that there's no choice but to just let us finish. The idea of this podcast is to document some of the interesting, inspiring, and funny conversations I've had with people I've met so that I can share them with you. I hope you enjoy. My next guest is a former Olympic swimmer who represented Mozambique at the 2016 Rio Games in the 100 meters butterfly. She also represented the country at the 2014 Youth Olympics in Ninjiang, China. At one point, she held 9 Mozambican junior records, of which 6 were also national records. She's a good friend of mine who I've known for almost 20 years. We went to school together back in Mozambique, and when I lived in the Netherlands, I lived with her and her family. She's an all-round lovely human being, and it's the one and only Yana Sunnershine. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. How are you doing?
Thank you very much for having me, Tom. I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm really excited to have this conversation. You're obviously here to talk, to kind of share your story about kind of getting to the Olympics and like the perseverance and work ethic around that. But and I think it actually fits quite well from my last episode about kind of getting started to anyone who listened to that. But just before we started, you actually shared something really interesting that before this whole story is about you swimming in the Olympics, but could you tell us a story of how you almost drowned as a child?
Yeah, so I was very young. I couldn't swim yet, and I was playing around the pool with my floaties on, and I decided to jump in the pool with my hands straight up into the air, and I think you can guess already, the floaties kind of came off, and I was kind of drowning. And my brother saw me drowning and he thought, hey, I got to go save my sister. So he jumped in the pool too, but he couldn't swim either. So we were both drowning at one point. And my parents had to like jump in the pool and save us.
Your parents, yeah, had to swim, right? It wasn't just like a consistent list of people jumping in.
Yeah, luckily. Luckily.
That's such a funny story. I love how that's like wonderfully building into the next kind of the next episode of you just kind of talking about your experience of swimming. But I suppose, do you want to kind of just give a bit of like a background of yourself, and then we can start with your kind of Mozambique and how you kind of got into swimming, and yeah, like and then I suppose we're going to eventually build up to like the Olympics.
Yeah, so I guess I first got into swimming when I almost drowned and thought it was a good idea. No, I'm kidding.
overcome this.
Yeah, so my brother actually started swimming when he was 6. Like, my parents wanted him to start swimming, and I went with him to one of his first practices, and I was like, hey, this is what I want to do too. So I asked my parents if I could come again. They said ask the coach, or if I could start as well, and he said, well, ask the coach. So we asked the coach if I could swim as well. He said, sure, come with your costume next time. So I came with my swimsuit the next practice, and he put me in one of the further lanes and gave me some laps to swim, and he was timing other swimmers as well, and I was like, hey, I want to be timed too, you know. So I kind of motivated myself. I thought it was fun, and from there I started training with them, and when I was 7 I started competing. I started competing in Mozambique. And at one point, I moved to Swaziland, and the conditions of the pool weren't as I was hoping for. Then I moved back to Mozambique, and from Mozambique, I moved back to the Netherlands, where I competed for a few years, and from there, I went to the U.S., where I did collegiate swimming.
Okay, and then after that. Was the U.S. Before or after 2016?
The U.S. was right before 2016.
Okay. That was actually one of the themes that I wanted to address a bit in this episode, the fact that you moved around quite a lot. And I'm sure some people who are listening to this probably haven't had to move around as drastically in order to chase a particular dream. So how did you kind of find living in 4 or 5 different countries, places, in order to chase this dream?
Okay, so living in five different places, each had different aspects that I could learn from, you know. I had different coaches, each had their own input, which added to my character and added to me as an athlete, you know. When I started in Mozambique, they helped me grow to a certain standard until I became kind of a big fish in a small pond, you know. And then I moved to the Netherlands and I was a small pond and a big fish. And my coach there had new insights on how he could make me a better athlete. And every coach that I had a different insight and a different way of making me better. So all in all, I think I learned a lot from these different coaches, where one was good in helping me improve my technique, and the other one was good in helping me like build my motor. So yeah, I think although a change is hard, a change also has new opportunities to grow.
Yeah, absolutely. You were in how long were you in Mozambique for, and what who were you swimming for when?
I had several coaches in Mozambique. I started with I learned to swim with Marisa, and then I started swimming with Gideon and Ilidiu at Naval. I swam a little bit with Patricio. I had Rui, and at one point I had, well, the coach that actually started with the project Rumo Rio. That's where we started with a group of athletes of that were trying to make the trying to compete at Rio. That coach was Eleuterio.
So you kind of like surround like lots of different coaches. You learned a lot from them and kind of moved around from different clubs. But there was one. It got to one point where this person was kind of starting a project and going, these are the people that we're going to try and get to compete at Rio.
Yeah, exactly. And that was the project.
I didn't know that. That's quite interesting.
Yeah, and the project was called Rumo Rio, and we trained. Well, we were trying to get athletes that were very motivated, and we're trying 2 times a week. Sorry, 2 times a day. We would start working. We worked a little bit with a nutritionist once or a few times. Yeah, and so we're trying to build a good base to bring athletes to the Olympic Games.
That's so interesting. And how old were you when you kind of joined that? Because I suppose it was back in Mozambique. You still moved around a couple of places before even ending up in Rio.
Yeah, I was 13 when I started that.
Wow, you're 13. And then at what point for you were you like, yeah, the Olympic Games is a goal that I want to achieve? And then also at what point were you like, this is actually quite a possible goal as well?
Well, hope I wanted to achieve it since I was like younger than 13, because you know, I started the program when I was 13. So it was always a big dream of mine. And then when I actually thought it could be reality was when I actually swam the Youth Olympic Games qualifying times, 2014. So that's when I was like, hey, I'm on the right track.
And then so from kind of like jumping back to kind of, or at least following chronologically, you said that so from Mozambique you went to Swazi, and you said you didn't have the best experience there.
Well, it wasn't the right conditions if I wanted to become an athlete.
How come?
When I went there, it was winter, and my parents said, "Hey, yeah, there's a swim team that you can join," and they train every other day, and you'll be in the right hands. But then, when I arrived at Waterford, I looked at the pool, and there was a dead rat in the pool because in the
A
winter.
dead rat.
Yeah. In the winter they don't
Oh
actually
my God.
Yeah, so in the winter they don't actually use the pool. So the club team was actually training in a hot spring, which had these two circular, I guess you can call them islands in the pool, and they weren't really lanes. So yeah, that's where I trained. But getting back to the dead rat, actually. When I saw the dead rats, the first thing I did was I threw my racing suit in the back of the boot of the car, And I was like,
Surprise.
well, I guess I won't be needing this one here.
Was there a moment where you're like, oh, well, swimming's over, or what did you do kind of anything else in order to like keep up swimming like competitively at least?
Yes, I mean, at that moment, it was kind of like a heartbreak,
Yeah.
I used to train in a nice pool, and now it's like, oh, we're swimming in a hot spring in the Caddo Paddo, which is kind of open to the public as well. I mean, it's more of a relaxing pool,
Did you
So,
call it the cuddle puddle?
yeah.
I mean, that would have been a hell of a story from the cuddle puddle to Rio. I can see a documentary being made out of that.
Yeah. I guess it's the podcast,
I mean, I hint to nudge nudge to any producers out there, but but. Okay, so then sorry, go on. You said so you couldn't really like train at that level, but then what happened?
Yeah, so I kind of, I guess I was the annoying little child that bothered my parents every other day, saying that I would like to go back to Mozambique and train there. And luckily they were very supportive, and they also kind of saw that swimming is a thing that you do now, like if you want to compete at a high level, it's something you have to do now when you're still somewhat younger, if you so they supported me, and they said, hey, okay, you can come back to Mozambique to study. But while I was still at I mean I still had a semester at Waterford. And while I was there, I would in the morning sometimes train a little bit with my brother on the football field. And every weekend, I would go home to Mozambique. And before I even got home, I went to the pool and I had trained. And I told my brother and my mom, who was driving the car, I said, or my dad, who was driving the car, you can take my bags home, So essentially,
Jeez. Okay, so like you'd come back every weekend and like find your own way to train. You train with your old club then.
yeah, so I would train with my old club before I even went home.
Jeez. I mean that just kind of shows like the level of kind of dedication that you had towards the swimming at least, especially if you taking it that seriously. And I think yeah, it's definitely quite a really very impressive and admirable that you kind of put that in the place as well. But then when you were at Waterford, the school in Swaziland, after that you said you came back to Mozambique then.
Yeah, I did. I was there for about a year, and then I moved to the Netherlands to train there at PSV.
How did you find that in comparison to kind of to Mozambique? Because for kind of context of how we know each other, because I came and lived in the Netherlands, yourself and your brother and your dad was there as well. And because your brother had gone there to pursue football, I'd gone there to join as well, pursue football. And then when you kind of first moved to the Netherlands, how did you find that in comparison to Mozambique? Because I suppose again for a bit more background, your parents are Dutch, and but then you kind of grown up you grew up in Mozambique, so I suppose kind of moving from Mozambique to Netherlands, how did you find that transition?
Well, first of all, like, yeah, I had a culture shock myself. I mean, I always spoke Dutch with my parents, but it's a more simple version of Dutch than people actually speak. People my age would speak. So, and also how people would act with each other was very different. I also came in the winter, which was kind of hard for me because I would swim. And I remember after one of the first practices, I got out of the pool and I didn't dry my hair because in Mozambique it was nice and warm. And I biked to school, and by the time I got to school, my hair was frozen. And I just remember one of my teammates saying, "Yana, don't touch your hair; it's gonna break."
Wow.
was
That's
something.
crazy.
Yeah, so I learned some things left and right, how to communicate with the people, what to do after practice. Also, practice itself were kind of interesting at first because Dutch abbreviations are very. I'd never seen a practice in Dutch before, like a training, and all of a
By
sudden there.
what do you mean by that in terms of like how they define what you need to do.
Yeah, so if it says 100 meters freestyle, it's different in English than in Dutch. Now, imagine if it's also abbreviated, and you don't even know.
Right.
First, you have to try find out what the abbreviation stands for, and then you have to try find out what that actually means.
You can't just really just follow what other people are doing.
Yeah. So it was a bit of a change. Also, yeah, exactly that. Going to school there as well. All of a sudden, everything was in Dutch. So it was. I had to adjust to everything, to the new lifestyle, schooling, and then the combination of swimming. But all in all, I think it was a very good experience. And I learned a lot from the training, and I also learned a lot on how to combine the two. Also, when you're struggling.
What kind of like got you through that? Was it this constant like drive of like I want to the Olympics? Was this kind of always the bigger picture in your head that like you're always there's a goal that I'm constantly working towards? Was it like a passion towards swimming? Were you just like, I just love this so much, I can get out of bed, this is absolutely fine. Kind of what would you say for you was that like driver to kind of get you out of bed?
I think it's a combination of things. It's first of all the motivation to achieve your goal. You know, you have this goal and you have to do what you have to do. You have to work for it. It's not going to come mm-hmm. for nothing. Second of all, it's also like your passion. I mean, I loved swimming. That's what I love to do. So when you love something, it makes it easier. Mm-hmm. And third of all, is also your teammates kind of become your family. And you can think like, hey, swimmers don't have a social life because they have to wake up so early. But your social life is actually also your teammates, you know?
Yeah.
It makes it fun to go, you know, when you have good teammates, it kind of, it's not considered a suffering anymore.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, because you're enjoying it, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
So, for my first quick fire question, I'll provide a bit of context. So for when Usain Bolt was asked what he ate before breaking the 100 meter record in 2008, he said he had chicken nuggets. So my question to you is, what was the last thing that you ate before your race at the Olympics?
Probably an overripe banana.
an overripe banana. Do you have like a... like a superstitious thing, kind of like where you have to eat a particular food or you have to eat something in a particular order before a race? You have like a little thing like that?
Yeah, so I actually I'm not really a fan of bananas, but that was the one thing.
Oh, okay.
Fried banana was what I would eat before my races. And also, I like to drink milk and honey.
That's interesting. Do you just have this like in your bag at all times, just in case?
not at all times, but... 9 out of 10.
More often than not.
Yeah.
Okay. This kind of leads to like the my next question, which is, if there was like one food that you had to eat for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Ooh, that's a very hard question. Like actual food, or could it be a snack too? Because if it's
it could
a snack,
be a snack,
I'd eat
just not like that.
I'd eat chocolate my whole life.
You'd eat chocolate. Oh yeah, I remember back in the Netherlands, just like feeding off chocolate, like left, right, and center. Just
oh yeah, my nutritionist wasn't too happy about it.
You're like, she's there giving you information. You're like, okay, no, I understand it, but how do you get chocolate into the diet? Like, where can I fit that in?
Yep.
That's so funny.
To be very honest, like once or twice. I know at one point we had to record what we were eating. I might have left a few
chocolate bars
out of there before I showed the list.
Yeah. Oh, that's so good. It's like, so you're like, oh, so this is going to be all throughout the week. And you're just like, no, I was really good this week. No, I promise. I only had 7 chocolate bars today. And then with all the wrappers are just like... Yeah, I'm sure she was, but like it's all in the past now. She can't do anything about it. that's so good, but that also kind of reminds me when Yeah, when I was living in the Netherlands, that the amount of stroopwafels that I would get to do as well was just definitely unhealthy. Like I think that's probably like one thing I miss a lot. Actually, to be fair, when I went to visit your brother a couple of back in April, and when I was there, I bought like a massive like tub of I say speculaas.
Speak last.
Yeah, that's the one. And then it got confiscated at the airport.
Oh no.
So I was going, I know, right? It's heartbreaking. I was going through security and they're like, what is this? I was like, I mean, obviously, you know what it is. And they're like, no, you can't take this. But I was like, it's not a liquid. Technically speaking, it's not a liquid.
I'm gonna let you.
So, but yeah, no, they didn't. I was fuming. It ruined my entire flight back. I was just not happy at all.
I guess you have a reason to come back, right?
Yeah, that too. And also, I was gonna say, like, next time that any of you come over, then you could bring me some, but you have to put it into your luggage, not your hand luggage, like I did, which was a horrendous mistake. I'll never be making that error again.
All right, I'll make sure to put some in my luggage.
So now, looking at the second part of this kind of podcast, we're focusing a bit more on your time at the Olympics. And I was also there at the Olympics with you, not competing, obviously, but as a volunteer. And then I was volunteering down by the velodrome at the track cycling, but I was only a couple of 100 meters away from you at the swimming arena. But yeah, I did manage to get to see you a couple of times, didn't I?
Yeah, you did. It was actually really funny. The one time that you came, you managed to sneak yourself into the training area of the swimmers just to have a look around and see what it looked like. Right then, Michael Phelps passed by, and you asked him for a picture. As if, sorry, you asked him for a picture, and he was like, "Sorry." As he was also surrounded by other people as well, and he's like, "Okay, I'm gonna take one more," and then he like chose you, and then I was like, your proud moment of the
I mean, no, obviously seeing you guys was a very proud moment, but like, yeah, no, I was like, yo, Michael Phelps, my buddy, my man. And then he went up and like he went like smashed his heat. I was like, yo, I mean, he needed a little bit of motivation from me, so
You're like his lucky charm.
exactly. So you're welcome, Michael. You could reply to my messages on Instagram, that'd be great. But yeah, no, so yeah, exactly. So like we managed to see each other a couple of times when we were there, because well, with the rest of the some of the other like Mozambican athletes as well, which was amazing. And but I suppose kind of just going back a bit, could you tell us like the feeling that you had when you first realized that, okay, I'm going to the Olympics? What was that experience like?
It wasn't very emotional, and also especially like once I was there and the day just before the opening ceremony, it was very emotional. I mean, I didn't get to go to the opening ceremony because I was competing the next day.
That's a shame.
Yeah, but it was still very emotional. Like, you're standing there, and yeah, you realize that all your hard work that you've put into it is, yeah, you achieved like your goal. This is what I wanted my whole life, and this is what I dreamt of when I was like 10 years ago. Yeah, just realizing that everything's reality, and yeah, that was very emotional.
That's crazy. That's I know, it's so like inspiring and so like admirable as well, that you kind of managed to, yeah, all the hard work paid off, like all this different there's different backgrounds, different like routes that you had to take in order to get there, kind of finally paid off. But so yeah, and then so what was the kind of actual race like? How did you feel like just before the race? Because you just did the heats, didn't you? And then
So I was really nervous. Of course, the Olympics is an event where all the whole world actually looks at, And so there's a lot of attention, and people are watching, and in the meantime you've received messages from people from all over the world that they're following you, and that there's so many people watching on like watching as you swim. So I got quite nervous, which kind of was a bit of my downfall as well, in my race. But still, I was very proud of to be there and represent Mozambique, at the Olympics.
Yeah, and not many people can say that, especially from such a kind of a small country like Mozambique, that you've joined like a club of a handful of people who have been able to say that they've represented like the country at the Olympic Games. So that's just incredible. I think it's amazing. But so yeah, and then like how what did you manage to kind of like meet any other people, have time to kind of chat with other athletes there? Obviously, like, I did manage to meet Michael Phelps, which is like by a ridiculous chance, but did you ever get to like kind of chat to any of the other athletes as well?
The Olympics are there. Sorry, the Olympics are like a very big sporting event, but it is also again a social gathering of athletes who love what they do, you know? And kind of at these big international events, you often also see people over and over again in the sense that like there are people that I met that I'd seen in Glasgow, which I then saw again in Nanjing, and then I saw again at the Rio Olympics. So you kind of get to know people from all around the world, and you see them more often. So you definitely get to talk to people. I wouldn't say that, like, for example, Usain Bolt, you never see him around.
I
He
mean,
kind of like
I
hides a little bit, so I've never got to
yeah,
talk to him.
that makes sense. 'Cause yeah, when even when I was in the training area, there were just like other just kind of just other swimmers that just wanted a picture with Michael Phelps. And so imagine if like these other kind of big name celebrities, like sort of celebrity athletes, will just kind of casually walking around, just they get like swamped by everyone, wouldn't they? Yeah. So I suppose what was your I suppose for those people who weren't necessarily aware and just kind of hearing for the first time that you competed at the Olympics, how did you and like wondering how you got on? What was your what was like how did you get on essentially? Because didn't you get a PB? Or at least for your best 50 or something, was that right?
At Rio, I unfortunately didn't get a PB.
Oh, your fastest split.
I believe I had my fastest split.
That was it. Sorry, that's what I meant. Yeah, sorry.
So I had my fastest split. So that was kind of where also my downfall was. I was so nervous that I used a lot of energy in my first 50. But therefore my last 50 was kind of where I lacked the energy to, to hold on that pace. So I kind of used, I used the energy in the wrong way. I didn't dose it as much as I would, what as much as I should have.
But so I know that since then you've stopped swimming, so you're not going to, or at least you've stopped swimming to the competitive level. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so unfortunately, you're not, that means you're not going to be going to Tokyo Olympics, which is next year, which is crazy how quickly that's come around. But so if you were the hypothetically, if you were to be going to these next Olympics, and you're kind of in the same position as well, like you're kind of building up to your just before your race, how is anything you kind of would have done differently, like now knowing what you know now?
I would have paid more attention on how to get myself relaxed, because at the Olympics you do get more attention than normal. There's all sorts of media. You get attention from left and right. All friends of yours that you haven't spoken to for the past 10 years all of a sudden send you a message. And of course, everyone's proud of you that you're there. But you know that there are just so many people watching, which could make you nervous. Not only your friends, but worldwide. So I would have paid more attention on how to, kill those nerves actually, especially right before the race. You know, like try find a little trick for yourself on how to stay cool.
Oh, that's that. I mean, that's certainly really interesting, and obviously, like hindsight is amazing. But it's one of those that if anyone else is kind of listening to this, probably unlikely that. I mean, there's a small chance that they will also be competing in the Olympic in the upcoming Olympics after listening to this. But I mean, I think this is definitely something that like applies to
different kind of situations where you've been working really hard for something. It could be like months or even years to reach a certain point, and then all of a sudden, like, you're at that point of like, how do you kind of maintain that, and what can you learn from other people who have got there as well? And I think that's like one thing that is quite, you bring it quite a very unique perspective to this, and I know, I think it'd be like really interesting and valuable for other people kind of to even like take one piece of information from this. You kind of had this whole experience of working really hard in order to kind of achieve this goal, and then you've like at least reached the Olympics. Whether or not the outcome there was probably not what you wanted is another story, but the fact that you got there is an incredible achievement within itself. But if there was kind of someone listening to this right now that had their own like personal Olympics, I'm kind of drawing a long parallel here in terms of they've got like this big thing that they're working towards, what would you tell them in order to keep them motivated, keep them going, something that you've learned along the journey, not necessarily just at the Olympics themselves, kind of what kind of keeps you going?
I guess that would sound very cliche, but keep working hard for it, and mm-hmm. If you have to leave certain things for it, then sometimes it's worth it. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I left the country a few times, or if for example there is a big, when I was growing up, there were sometimes social events that I couldn't attend because I had to leave it. That's sometimes part of the game. If you have to sacrifice certain things, sometimes that's best if that's what you to achieve your goal. Mm-hmm. But most importantly is just remember to have fun and enjoy what you're doing. If you don't enjoy it, then it's going to be a lot harder. It sounds very cliche, but that is comes down to,
But cliches are there for, they're cliches for a reason, in the sense that there's probably usually the kind of the best way in order to explain something is through that kind of that cliche. But no, I think that's a really important message, and thank you very much for sharing that.
I also think that, of course, other than that, you have to make sure that you have to have the right support around you. I was very fortunate to have like my parents, my brother, friends of mine, coaches that supported me, and also the decisions I made, and also thought with me about the decision. Sometimes it's best to talk to someone like, hey, should I or should I not do this? I remember before going to the States, I was like, I don't know. Should I or should I not? I looked into it with a positive mindset. I was like, hey, you know what? If I don't like it in the States, I can always come back after a year, So I was like, hey, I'm going to go for my swimming. I'm going to see if I can combine it with my university.
Yeah.
And if I don't like it, or if I don't like it, then I can always come back. And I could only do that because of the support system that I had, that they were like, well, and also their view on it. They were like, it's going to be okay. If you decide that, then it's fine.
That's amazing. And it definitely makes such a difference if you have kind of like the people around you that kind of support you like in that dream or that goal that you're kind of trying to achieve, no matter how big or small it is. You've kind of got people who are there giving you like, I suppose, the right feedback, or they're like just being honest with you, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And also the coaches are a great support system as well. I know when I was coming back from the US, my coach reached out to me as well, and he Rob Guinness, he reached out to me just before I was coming back to the Netherlands, and he supported me as well and wanted to help me out. So he was my old coach, and
that's amazing. You're definitely very fortunate to be in that kind of situation and having those people around you as well.
Definitely.
There's just one more thing that I actually wanted to talk about, but it was a story of what happened in when we were in Rio. Do you remember when we went to the Jamaica house? So I thought this was a really, really funny story, and I think this is a nice kind of way just to round this off. But so during the Olympics, a number of countries had their own cultural houses available for the public to go in and kind of like experience some culture. They either had food, they had shops, they had exhibitions. The Jamaica House had like essentially had a nightclub. It was like it was a party house in the evenings, which will not shock many people. But so I think it was you and Igor, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So we were like, okay, yeah, we want to go to this the Jamaica House and just have like a good night, see if we can get in. So we got an Uber down there, and we saw this queue was like this massive queue as well. So we stood in line, and as we started chatting to some people, we figured out that there was a list that you had to book in advance in order to get into the Jamaica House. And we were just there like, oh yeah, we haven't been on the list. Like, I don't know what we're going to do. Are we going to just stand in this line and then just get rejected at the front? But so then what happened? There were these guys there in front of us, right? And he had some friends that were meant to be coming, but then they couldn't make it anymore. Fortunately, there was three people that weren't making it anymore, and all their names were still on the list. So we were like, okay, cool. We're going to take these names, right? So, but then because it was three of his male friends. So, and then there was myself, Igor, and you. So obviously, not being a male, they were like, well, this is going to be an issue with the names. And then I can't remember what the other names was, but like one of them was like, do you remember what it was? It was like...
My name was Chris Reynolds.
Oh, do you remember what? You remember what it was?
Yeah.
That was amazing. So like, so it was like Chris, and we're like, you know what, Chris is short for Christine. Like,
exactly.
that's good enough. Like they can't question it. So, we go all the way. We're like, this is an omen. This is like just meant to happen. So we get to the front, and they're like, okay, guys, can we have your names? And obviously, because we know the names off by heart, because we've been practicing them in the queue, they check the names, and the names are there. So they're like, okay, well, we can't. These people are legitimate. Like, they didn't know the names. They haven't just made it up. But then they're like, oh, can we see some ID? And we're like, yeah, sorry, we don't have any ID on us. And then they're like, oh, can you like show us like Facebook or like something like that? And we're like, oh, we don't have internet because we're not from here, so we haven't got the internet package. And then I think they just looked at us and they're like, you know what, like we're not gonna argue with you guys. So we know that they probably knew that we were lying anyway, but they're like, yeah, I'm scared.
I believe they even saw like the Olympic sign on Igor's and asked for his credentials from the Olympics.
Oh, seriously? Oh, I forgot about that.
I thought so. I'm not too sure.
Yeah, so they were like, oh yeah, because obviously like you two were athletes, and then I was just the volunteer. But I was like, yeah, no, just lie, just say. I was like, yeah, I play, I don't know, I play croquet or lawn bowls or some non-serious thing that no one probably watched. Yeah, and then they're like, what did you say to that? They're probably, oh, I don't have my credentials or whatever.
At this point, they were just like, just go through.
Yeah, they were just like, you guys are just, we know that you're lying. We don't have time for this. Just go in. You've got the names, whatever. Exactly. They're like, you know, just for the effort that you put in, like, we'll just let you in. And then we ended up having such a good night as well.
Yeah.
It was a really fun night. And I think it was the same night as like the 100 meter semifinals.
Yeah, so, same at Usain Bolt.
Yeah, because Usain Bolt ran. They were playing music, and then they stopped the music so that we could watch the race. And then it was Usain Bolt and Johan Blake. And then afterwards, I remember the DJ going, oh, yeah, we spoke to Usain Bolt's manager, and we're going to get him down to come down to the Jamaica House. And everyone was like, ah, no way. And then obviously he didn't. But I remember that happening as well. That was a really good night. But yeah, no, Rio was really fun. That was a lot of fun. So yeah, that kind of brings us to the end of the podcast, and just kind of wrap up. There were just two more things to do. So firstly, so Yana, for anyone who's kind of listened to this and be like, oh, that's super interesting. I don't know, necessarily find out more or just kind of like follow you. Are there any kind of like your Instagram or Twitter or something that where people can find you?
Yeah, I have Facebook and Instagram. Mm-hmm. My Facebook is Yana Sunshine. Mm-hmm. And my Instagram is j.sunandshine.
Cool. Amazing. And then I've got this, I'll have that written in the description as well for anyone who wants to find it. And
make that Instagram yana.sunandshine.
yana.sunandshine. Oh, you have like your private account and then your celebrity account.
No, I think I just changed my username once.
All right. fair enough. And last one, I think I mentioned this to you before, but it's like this mini segment called For the Road. And essentially it was just like, if you have anything to promote, any kind of charities or causes that you want to raise awareness to, this is like a little space for you to do that. So I was just wondering if you had anything to, if there's anything you wanted to share.
Yeah, so it's actually quite inspiring. There's the Maarten van der Weijden Foundation. Maarten van der Weijden is an old Dutch Olympian, an ex-Dutch Olympian, who actually suffered from cancer in 2001. Mm-hmm. And he won the cancer, like he beat the cancer. And in 2008, he actually became a gold medalist in the Olympic Games. And now he started a foundation where he tries to swim 22 kilometers between 11 different cities in 72 hours. And wow. The money that he raises for that, he wants to use for researching on cancer. And it's actually going to his next attempt. He's done it, attempted it once, and his next attempt is going to start, I believe, the 21st of June.
Oh, wow. So that's really soon.
Yeah, so that's very soon. So yeah, I think that's really great and something that really deserves some attention.
That's amazing. So if you can like share the links with me, and then I can put that into the descriptions as well. And then if anyone wants to check that out, then it'll all be there.
Definitely will. The thing I said about 11 cities, mm-hmm. actually comes from the Dutch concept. There is a competition actually for ice skating, which is called the 11 Stedentocht. Elfstedentocht, sorry.
Yeah.
It's in Dutch. And actually, it was like in previous years, ice skaters, whenever the weather was allowed, they would skate between 11 different cities. And now he has done that, but now, or he hasn't done it yet. He has now incorporated that into swimming between 11 different cities.
Jeez, that's super interesting. And how does he do that? Is that like in canals or is that...
Yeah, canals, waterways. Mm-hmm. I'm not too sure which way route he takes.
Cool. That sounds really interesting, and I'll definitely be sharing that for everyone else to be able to find and have a look. So thank you so much for sharing that.
Thanks, Tom.
Cool. And lastly, just a massive, massive, massive thank you for joining me on the podcast. This is like such a really interesting conversation. And you are like one of the first people who I wanted to speak to when I started thinking about this. I really appreciate you making the time for to join me on the podcast. So yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you so much as well. And I really wish you all the best with your podcast and your upcoming podcast as well. I'm going to look forward to them.
Thank you.
I'll definitely be tuning in.
That's amazing.